Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Markets Show, welcome back, listener. It is Thursday, the 29th of September, as we record around midday. Important to get that in case anything happens. Joining us as normal, Dan Jones hosting. Hi, Dan.
Hi, John. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Economics writer and the most busy person in the EFT, Hermione Taylor, joins us. Hi.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
We've got Mitchell Labiak as well. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. And then over the line, we've got our regulars. Mark Robinson. Hi, Mark.
Hi, John. Always a pleasure.
And Julian Hoffman. Hi, Julian.
Hey, John. How you doing?
Lovely to have you all with us. Dan, coming up on today's show.
Yeah, we are starting in the obvious place, looking at the fallout from the mini budget that was anything but mini, certainly in terms of the reaction to it. We're going to be discussing the many facets and the many consequences and possible consequences of that shortly. Then we're going to be looking at our cover story this week, which is on buy-to-let and buy-to-let investing and the various difficulties that are arising there, again, in any number of ways. And finally, we are going to look at a bit of company reporting as well. Our result of the week this week is Saga, which has had a tough time of it itself. So, yeah, we'll be digging into that.
Lovely stuff. Quick news roundup before we get there. So this morning, Liz Truss is on a media blitz and she's doubled down on her tax cutting plans. The budget, as you will already know, listener, prompted a sell-off in sterling and government bonds and put the markets in a spin. More from Dan and Co. On the fallout to come. Some companies lines. Unilever chief executive Alan Jope will retire at the end of next year after 5 years in the job. The company said the board have started the search for a successor already. Last week, we reported that LXI REIT had made a £500 million offer for supermarkets from Sainsbury's. This week, however, they have U-turned on the deal due to, quote, stock market volatility. Pub chain JD Wetherspoons has put 32 of its pubs in England up for sale. A spokesperson for the company said that this is a commercial decision. In its last trading update, Spoons lowered its guidance and expects a loss of around £30 million for this financial year. Russian gold miner Polymetal is back looking for a chair after Ricardo Orsil resigned after only 6 months in the job. It comes after the miner cancelled its 2021 final dividend, something long expected following sanctions against the Russian company. High street retailer Next has cut their pre-tax profit guidance to £840 million from £860 million. Sales in the second half of this year are also forecast to fall by 1.5%. And finally, Spirax Sarco Engineering is buying the US-based industrial equipment maker Durex International for around £320 million. That's all from me. Over to you, Dan.
Thanks, John. I suppose we should clarify that Spirax deal is for a different Durex, the one that listeners might be familiar with. Let's start with the big news of the week. Where else are we going to start? Hermione, as John said, is here with us again. It's always bad news when you're here, Hermione, because it tends to mean something has gone wrong. Let's start with very basically, you know, why markets have reacted the way they have to the mini budget. Again, you know, sterling bond prices selling off. What happened basically? What triggered that response?
Yeah, what a week it's been. So I'm sure you'll have heard the government saying that their policies are designed to encourage growth and they believe that cutting tax will help get the economy back on track and they're aiming for a 2.5% growth target. The problem is that these policies represent a really big fiscal expansion. So you've got the energy price guarantee policy that they've already announced, which is going to cost up to £60 billion over the next 6 months, depending on energy prices. And then on Friday, they introduced a new round of tax cuts, which look like they're going to cost around £45 billion a year by the end of the forecast period. And so this is, firstly, quite a bad fit for the economic environment that we find ourselves in. So we've already got very high inflation, and there are concerns that if the government is doing this huge fiscal stimulus, that could make the Bank of England's job even harder. There's also concerns that even though they talked a lot about growth in the supply side, are these policies really going to address any of the sort of long-term issues that we're facing in the UK? You know, and are they going to improve productivity in the long term? I think the biggest concern, really, though, is that the government's credibility. is not high at the moment. So they announced these very expensive policies without any forecasts or costings from the fiscal watchdog of the OBR, the Office for Budget Responsibility. They've had quite an adversarial relationship with the Bank of England, kind of repeatedly criticising it during the leadership election campaign. And then they keep railing against what they call economic orthodoxy. So all of that adds up to markets being pretty spooked by what's going on.
You can make some criticisms of economic orthodoxy, of course, but as you say, it seems to be the credibility deficit, which is something I wrote about this week as well, has been what has spooked markets this week. Obviously, we've seen sterling fall off, and then we saw the big movement in bond yields as well, which we'll come on to shortly. There are lots of interesting questions, really, but the first one we start with is, what is the Bank of England going to do? Do we think, you know, because on the one hand, as you say, it's already in a tightening cycle. It's got to raise rates in an effort to combat inflation, which it is doing. Now there's potentially policies which, you know, are going to spark more growth, or at least, you know, that's certainly the aim. And therefore, you would think the bank is going to raise rates more. But at the same time, there are now, given where market pricing is, there are big risks to the mortgage market, things like that, in terms of how high rates could potentially go or forecast to go.
Yeah, I mean, this week market pricing was suggesting some huge rate hikes in the future. So seeing rates going as high as 6% and kind of front loading that with a big hike in November. I mean, this could cause big problems in the housing market. We've seen some short-term problems where lenders didn't really want to take the risk that yields might shift again between them offering a mortgage and hedging a loan. So we saw lots of products withdrawn. But then over and above that, there are going to be some really big affordability concerns. So lenders are passing on this kind of risk-free rate. Can borrowers afford such high mortgage interest repayments? This has got some really big implications for the housing market. We could even see people selling because they can't afford their repayments, or buyers having to really adjust, you know, their expectations of what they can get because affordability will be so squeezed. And that could put some very downward pressure on house prices. The housing market is a kind of a big part of the UK economy as well. And if higher mortgage costs start eating up people's disposable income at the same time as high inflation, we could see household income really kind of plummet. And that could kind of worsen any recession that we see over the winter as well.
And this is really the potential, you know, crux of the problem for the Bank of England. You wrote about in a separate column this week in the magazine about the ECB and Zugzwang, the chess term where, you know, there are no good moves available. And in some ways, that's what faces the Bank of England now, because, as you say, the housing market is such a big part of the UK economy that, to me at least, it feels like they really can't raise rates to the market implied levels because of what that will do to the housing market and therefore the economy. But the flip side, of course, is then that means inflation is going to be higher, even higher, for even longer. It means more sterling weakness potentially if they don't. You know, we've already seen a lot of sterling weakness, and that's when they're pricing in 6% market rates next year. So if the market has to have a reality check on that, then who knows what's going to happen to the pound then as well.
I mean, I wrote a couple of weeks ago about the Bank of England having, kind of difficulties having to try and counteract the government stimulus. But things have got even worse for the Bank of England now because it's having to juggle financial stability and think about the exchange rate as well. I mean, I think there's quite a strong argument that sterling doesn't seem to be very sensitive to what the Bank of England does to interest rates. When the Bank of England hiked rates earlier this year, it kind of moved more decisively than other advanced economies, and that didn't really do much to help the pound. I think, as you say, it's maybe quite telling that even when markets were expecting really big interest rate hikes, maybe even 6% down the line, it didn't really do much to bolster sterling. So I think it's probably quite unlikely that the Bank of England will act to try and do anything to kind of boost sterling, because it would have to be very hawkish. I think the Bank of England might be concerned that a weak exchange rate could be inflationary, so it will make imports more expensive and it will kind of boost exports. But I think probably that will be quite easily counteracted by higher rates. And as you say, the bank has to consider now that if it does hike rates up to 6%, that could trigger some real sort of distress in the housing market. And some economists, so Pantheon Macroeconomics, are actually arguing that if we did see interest rates of 6%, the housing market effects would mean that inflation could then push below target, so that could actually force the Bank of England to undershoot its inflation target. So I think it's probably more realistic that they will let sterling slide further and then rates will go to maybe 4 or 5%.
I suppose that's indicative of perhaps of the range of possible outcomes here, the uncertainty. You know, obviously, if we were to suddenly flip to a deflationary scenario, it would be, you know, a few months away. But nonetheless,
yes,
it's still very much not what is being anticipated right now. I suppose the other thing we should talk about, you mentioned financial stability. We should talk about the bond market episode, shall we say, yesterday, where you know, we could get into the weeds of liability-driven investment, but no one's probably going to thank us for that. But in short, you know, a lot of these big moves in gilt yields yesterday were seemingly exacerbated by pension fund selling, you know. Ironically, these pension funds, you know, we talk a lot in the magazine about how higher gilt yields mean better situations for pension funds in terms of their funding position, but they do also have a lot of derivative positions, have a lot of hedges in their portfolios, which are effectively hedges against, ironically, big moves in UK government bond prices. And obviously, that's what we've seen in the past few days. So in short, all the people they have the hedges with asked for a lot more collateral on these hedges. The only thing they could really get their hands on to sell was government bonds. That exacerbated the government bond sell-off, and it created a bit of a doom loop then when they needed more collateral and they had to sell more and so on and so on. So that's where the Bank of England stepped in. But what does that mean in terms of what has the Bank of England done there?
I mean, I think this case just really highlights what a long time a week is in economics at the moment. So on Thursday, the Bank of England said, so last week, that there was going to be a high bar for amending their planned reduction in the stock of purchase gilts, and they were going to embark on quantitative tightening. So they were going to start, they were stopping QE and embarking on active quantitative tightening. Earlier this week, they then had to do some very targeted asset purchases at the long end of the market, and they said that for 13 days they're going to purchase up to £5 billion worth of long-dated bonds, which totals £65 billion. So having said that, you know, the QE was over and they're starting on QT, they had to move very, very quickly and take a very different track to try and restore some kind of order in the bond markets.
That, fingers crossed, does seem to have happened for now. Obviously, they're only doing it for a couple of weeks, but hopefully markets in general will have settled down a bit by 2 weeks' time, but who knows what will be happening by then. Let me bring in Julian and Mark. Maybe if we just talk about a couple of things. Again, we could spend the whole podcast discussing these issues, and we've got a lot of detail in the magazine this week as well. But I suppose when we look at it on a company level, first of all, we look at the sectors coming out best and worst from the past few days, potentially in the weeks and months ahead, from, you know, higher bond yields, lower sterling perhaps as well. There's obviously implications for all kinds of sectors, be it real estate, to, you know, banks, insurers, things like that. Mark and Julian, I don't know if any particular areas stand out to you.
Well, the obvious one, I guess, is the insurers, which is sort of my nominal beat. The companies took a real swan dive on yesterday and then sort of recovered a bit of ground today. So we're talking about the life insurers to start with. I mean, their problem, I guess, as Hermione has explained, really, is that they have to match the length of their liabilities with assets which will cover their liabilities over the same amount of time. So and the movements in the gilt market would have affected them quite badly. But having said that, it is actually really an indirect problem in that it's the pension funds themselves rather than the life insurers directly that are affected by it. So it's you do have a kind of Chinese wall between the two, although they do write their own business to a certain extent and take out hedges. But I mean, the fact that they've recovered today is kind of indicative of you know the fact that the Bank of England has stepped in, and there are no further suggestions that they're going to have any trouble with financing their hedges and their balance sheets. So yeah, I mean that was the most obvious company hit that people took. I mean, the other one obviously is the banks. How are they going to be affected by long-term rising interest rates? So generally we'd probably say that it's going to be positive for them. The only unknown is really how many people are going to default on loans, or we don't really know what the impairment implications are of interest rates, particularly if they hit 6%. 6-7% seems to be the cutoff point for a lot of people's finances. So it's, you know, we don't know what that scenario is, although they have been planning for months really that the situation would get worse. So that you have been seeing a lot of banks in particular putting more money aside to cover potential bad loans in this situation. So I wouldn't expect them to be overly affected, and they'll essentially benefit from widening margins as the interest rates go up. So I mean, those are the two most exposed sections. I don't know, what did you come across anything, Mark, yourself?
Well, just on that point as well, I did note recently that we're starting to see a slight increase in loan delinquencies over in the US at the moment, and the housing market there has come under renewed pressure as well. And to Hermione's point before as well, I think it would be interesting to look at the overall UK savings rate, because that will inform the level of loan distress over here too, and sort of people need to keep this in mind. And then
yeah, I looked it up the other day. It's the highest since 2010.
So, I mean, that's going to have some act as some kind of a buffer, hopefully going forward. But non-performing loans, that's going to be a significant part of the equation too. I guess Dan was saying earlier on, you know, big dollar earners will sort of obviously take advantage through sterling sort of fall at the moment. And I guess it's worth pointing out too that consumers were actually standing to benefit from a reduction in energy prices, particularly wholesale gas prices, which have eased over the last 6 weeks or so. But of course, all that's priced in US dollars. And so that benefit, for at least for consumers, is going to sort of level out as well. But it's perhaps telling that the UK benchmark, the FTSE 100, that's still holding up reasonably well compared to its overseas counterparts, because about 70% of the stocks therein derive a large proportion of their earnings in US dollars.
We should probably emphasize that. The energy price point you just touched on, Mark, because there is a rare piece of good news this week. You know, the fall in energy prices has been quite significant. They did spike up again a little bit on the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage, but the fall, you know, compared with the late August highs, has really been quite major. And in fact, it is, you know, if they stay at these levels, it should really reduce the cost to the government of that energy price guarantee. But I digress. The other interesting thing from a company perspective, again, I suppose it's quite intuitive, but I was just looking at a list of, you know, who's done best over the past week. And, you know, best is a relative term. We're looking at, you know, 1-2% up here in most cases. But the likes of, you know, the consumer staples, Unilever, Reckitt, companies like that, have, again, you know, a good amount of earnings in dollars. They also, you know, so far have made a decent fist of being able to pass on inflation to consumers as well. So they're still looking in decent shape there, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, these defensive stocks will always do relatively well under these circumstances. I guess their model isn't completely divorced from energy prices as well. But, you know, we've seen a further reinforcement in the sort of swing towards value stocks over the last month too. And that's likely to continue well into next year.
Yeah, well, of course, we will be monitoring all these developments in a lot more detail as the days and weeks go on. And we'll have a lot more in this issue, as I've said, and also in next week's issue as well, about some of the consequences that are really just starting to emerge now from fiscal and monetary policy and the clash thereof, perhaps. But let's move on for now. Let's talk about our cover story this week. Mitchell, the author of said story, has been sitting patiently while we discuss all these issues. But the piece is on buy-to-let investing, which, you know, is harder than it once was, and it was already harder before the prospect of even higher mortgage rates came through this week. But, you know, we don't want to forget the other side of the coin as well, which is what this piece looks at, which is, of course, tenants. And, you know, in the context of a structurally, you know, broken or certainly damaged housing market, the difficulties a lot of people are facing, whether they be a landlord facing costs coming through, whether they be a tenant facing, you know, significant rent rises, maybe as those costs are passed on, it's a very difficult balancing act. And the piece kind of explores some of these dynamics, as well as housing market dynamics as well, Mitch.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think obviously a housing market that functioned properly would be of an immense benefit to buy-to-let landlords and tenants alike. If you had a situation whereby, you know, tenants were renting because they wanted to, because they were really keen on it, because, you know, it was one option among many that they could choose from, then buy-to-let landlords would be able to offer products in the same way that sort of any other seller of products, offers products. But the situation we've got at the moment is the phrase housing crisis is used sort of ad nauseum, but that is sort of where we are. And because of that, you have a lot of tenants who are renting, well, yeah, because they have to. And this in turn means that it's being a buy-to-let landlord is different. It's different from offering sort of other products, because you're not offering something tenants necessarily always want, but what they can afford and what they need. So it presents sort of a whole host of problems that are unique to that particular market.
And yeah, as we say, you know, right now landlords are going to be looking at their own costs going up. They're also probably conscious that they don't want void periods. They don't want to, you know, raise the rents to a level where, you know, the tenants have to move and then you get the void period and then you have to get someone else in. Obviously, the tenants don't want that either at the moment. You know, we are seeing, certainly in London where we are, some significant rent increases. So it's tricky. But the piece as well, we do, I think, talk in a bit more detail about various aspects of this, both that kind of negotiation, but also some of the factors behind it, not least regulatory changes, legislative changes that have happened and that could happen as well. We've seen a lot of changes to the way that landlord taxation, buy-to-let investing is taxed over the last few years. And now coming down the line, we've got things like the Renters Reform Bill, energy performance certificate changes as well. Can you talk a bit about both of them?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so the Renters Reform Bill is not yet a bill. Mm. So that's the first thing to bear in mind. But it is, you know, it's something, it's got cross-party support for a start. So you've got, there was a white paper in response to a government consultation, but it was seen by tenant groups and landlord groups alike as a very informed and lengthy response, which would imply that a bill is on the way. And so a lot of people in the industry are talking about a bill, even though the bill doesn't exist just yet. You've also got, Labour sort of supporting the exact same ideas, only calling it a renters reform charter. So whatever form it takes, these changes are on the way. So within the renters reform bill or renters reform white paper is a sort of promise to get rid of no-fault evictions, they're called no-fault evictions, but they're evictions via Section 21 notice, whereby a landlord doesn't have to give a reason for evicting a tenant. And this is something which already exists in Scotland. So we can often look to Scotland as an indication of what England and Wales might look like when these sort of changes come in, because it seems like, once again, with this cross-party support and so much sort of political weight behind it, that it is a matter of when rather than if. And of course, Scotland showing that, you know, it can be done. The energy performance certificate, that is something that's perhaps hard to say whether it's more significant, but more significant in the sense that there is a minimum energy efficiency standard and the government has every intention of increasing the threshold for that minimum energy efficiency standard. The real question is when they'll do it by, but they're looking at increasing it to a C. At the moment, it's an E. So
this is just to be clear, that obviously the grading you get on the property.
Yeah, and there are problems with this grading system in of itself. I mean, a lot of people argue that it's quite haphazardly measured. I don't know if anyone's ever been in a house when an energy performance certificate is performed, but it's very much like a sort of stick your finger in the air and you get a rating. So on the one hand, it shouldn't be too onerous for landlords to meet an EPC of C. On the other hand, not being aware of the changes at all, could be problematic. And there could be a lot of ignorance of this particular threshold, especially when you consider all the other sort of legislative changes landlords have to keep up with, which is a point made by not just landlord groups, but tenant groups as well.
I suppose it's an interesting contrast, perhaps, with with France as well, which the thing I keep raising, just I find it quite interesting in a way. There, you know, the energy crisis there. One thing they have done is prevented landlords with substandard properties from an energy from an energy cost perspective, prevented them from raising rents effectively. So saying if your building is not as well insulated as it should be, then you can't raise the rent. And this is in a way kind of similar like that, you know.
I don't know the ins and outs of the French detail, but in a way it's more extreme because the way it should work, and it's the same for commercial property as well. But if your property doesn't meet a certain threshold, at the moment it's an E, then you can't let that property at all, let alone raise the rents. So it's the idea is that it is a, hence the name, it's a minimum energy efficiency standard. The idea is that this is the minimum a property has to be. The scale goes all the way down to G, but if your property is F or G, then you can't put it on the market yet. You have to get up to a higher standard before you're allowed to rent it. It isn't extreme. You know, the movement up to E hasn't caught out. Hasn't been as dramatic as perhaps people might have feared. That happened around 2020 off the top of my head, but so that movement, that threshold has already happened and the market has had 2 years to react to it, maybe longer off the top of my head. But yeah, moving the threshold to C should be doable. I mean, we need it to be doable if we're going to meet sort of various other energy efficiency and net zero targets. So,
and we should we will maybe skirt over briefly the budget changes. Obviously, there's the stamp duty cut, albeit that's relatively small beer in the context of potentially rising mortgage rates. You know, saving a couple of grand there. Also, some changes though if you do have properties in private companies, because of the way corporation tax increases have been reversed, and because of also the dividend tax changes. But you can find out more details of those in print and online. But it does lead us on to another point raised in the piece, which is that, you know, if you have these properties in a company, then fine. But a lot of buy-to-let investors are single property, you know, small landlords. And there are other players moving into the market, which could be a threat, maybe an opportunity as well.
Yeah, well, so this is the thing that I thought was the most interesting when I began looking into this. I first began looking into this when I was writing about real estate investment trusts and why so few of them are involved in build to rent. But essentially, yeah, we have this situation whereby in the UK, the vast majority of the market, so we're talking 98.5% of the market, is not sort of institutional build to rent capital. The vast and a big chunk of the market is really small time players. We're talking landlords that have one, two, three, maybe four properties. But yeah, a huge portion of the market, whatever way you look at it, is maybe they own a company, but they're not the sort of institutional level scale like a pension fund or a listed company or even a large private equity fund. They're smaller sort of players. You compare that with the US, where 47% of the market is what is known as build to rent. There are these enormous sort of companies that build tower blocks and rent them out, but not necessarily tower blocks. Sometimes they'll build houses in the way house builders will build them, but then they'll rent those out as well. So this is the way the UK market could be headed. I mean, that's certainly what the UK build to rent, BTR for short, the UK BTR players believe, and they're pouring a lot of money into the sector. And they poured a record amount of money into the sector in the first half of this year and also a record amount of money into the sector last year. So that's what, whether they like it or not, that's sort of what buy-to-let landlords will have to compete with, is these big-time professional players. The government certainly is supportive of it, but of course the buy-to-let landlords I spoke to for the piece, and also the tenants and the tenant campaign groups I spoke to for the piece, were not, you know, they didn't necessarily think it was the best of news that we'd have a more professionalized, more business-like sector for a variety of reasons. I mean, one of which being that if you've got an individual landlord, it's quite easy to contact them, but if you're renting from an enormous company, it's it's a bit more of a bureaucratic process, but you have a more professionalized product that you're living in. So it has its ups and downs. But either way, that's what the BTR developers want. Sorry, Mark, what are you going to say?
Yeah, Mitch, I was just thinking it falls in with this general notion theme that a lot of the regulations linked to environmental policy seem to have a disproportionately negative effect on small business, and i.e. Small landlords. I mean, there's a obviously a political angle to this as well, but it would be interesting if we do go down that US route too, because I know sort of financial companies are gaining large levels of exposure to the US rental property market as well. I'm thinking here of BlackRock, but there are a couple of other examples too. So, you know, perhaps we do go down that corporatist route in the UK too. But I can't see how this would necessarily increase the stock of rental properties. I mean, surely these things just act as a disincentive, unless, as you float the idea as well, that perhaps we just end up with sort of large corporations in that corner of the market.
It's hard to know whether it'll increase the overall stock. I suppose it's more about proportion, isn't it? It's, you know, what proportion of the market is going to end up owned by build-to-rent developers. I mean, I suppose that's more what it comes down to. And also that 47% point, I mean, Savills are obviously very bullish about the idea of BTR, because of course they would be, because they sometimes represent BTR clients, but they reckon we'll get to about, at full maturity, they call it, they reckon it'll be about a third of the market, which is not 47%. And that's also quite a bullish estimate. And of course, full maturity could be years away, or it could, well, it's more likely to be decades away. So there's a lot that could happen between then and the sort of BTR market reaching full maturity. But in the meantime, it's fair to say that buy-to-let landlords have competition on the way.
We should move on to our final segment, which is our result of the week this week, taking a backseat slightly to the dramatic headline events. But nonetheless, there have been a lot of companies reporting again this week, some doing okay, some inevitably at the current time struggling a little bit. And one of those was Saga, the insurer. And Julian, you, as you mentioned earlier, cover the insurers, and you covered this particular set of results, which was a little bit disappointing, and the market reacted accordingly.
Yes, yeah, they didn't do very well at all. Incidentally, this is also Mark's favourite holiday company. I thought I'd just get that.
You've said that. Go on.
Well, I just the old ones are always the best.
Indeed.
I was just saying that the problem with Saga's been in a bit of a tailspin for a couple of years anyway, because the pandemic hugely affected their cruise line business. They sort of take grey-haired people around the Mediterranean in large numbers. But also the insurance business seems to be suffering quite badly. And they had, the weird thing about this result was it was down 20%, their shares were down 20% on the day, but they had actually warned the market in July that they had some issues in their insurance business. But no one seems to have been prepared for the fact is how deep and pernicious these were. And what caused the results to be quite so bad was a massive impairment they had to take on goodwill in their insurance business. So they're not selling new business in there. They're not writing new business as profitably as they were before. And it seems to be that they underestimated the extent of that problem, which is why they had to land a more than 250 to 240 million impairment on the results. The market wasn't impressed, to say the least. It's just one of those things. The problem they have is that they can't charge our existing customers more. I mean, the FCA outlawed so-called price walking earlier this year, and all the insurers have been affected by this kind of problem. But it seems to have hit Saga more than anyone else, which is kind of unusual in that, you know, the situation was predicted, really. But yeah, sorry, Mark, you were going to say something.
No, it was just in relation to that, the inability to actually increase premium rates. Is that fully mandated? Is that due to regulatory issues rather than anything else.
They didn't specify it particularly, but it can only be that. I mean, the thing is that their retention rate is quite high anyway. It was always quite high, and the suspicion is that they were able then to charge premiums to their existing customers, which is what the insurance industry kind of relied on, really. And for some reason, not being able to do that has badly affected how they're writing new business. So it's, the suspicion from a lot of people is that it's a management miscalculation. I think that's why the market reacted so badly. But only time will tell.
I didn't have a look at the comments regarding their cruise lines as well. But I just wonder if that area of the holiday market has followed the sort of dynamic of the aviation sector, so where you've had a sort of recovery, but it's been a slower recovery, less intense recovery than we might have thought since the pandemic. And there were a lot of logistical issues involved with cruise lines. I mean, in fact, I think that was the first corner of the market to be adversely affected by the pandemic as well. I can't remember. Carnival, I think, had a couple of their ships that were sort of held in port because of, you know, the virus was spreading throughout the ships themselves. And so I think they've had to take a lot of clinical measures designed to, you know, protect passengers as much as possible. And of course, with the demographic that they target, that's an even more important issue. I would just be interested to see the bookings for next summer as well, because I can't help think there's, like aviation, there's been some kind of delay there for the recovery.
Well, it's entirely possible. I mean, I don't know anyone who's going on a cruise anytime soon. I don't know about you. And there's loads of ships still tied up along the coast. If you know, from where I live, you go down either direction, there's still five or six cruise liners sitting in sheltered bays. So,
but there's bound to be a certain percentage of people as well who just wouldn't countenance again after what happened during the start of the pandemic.
I mean, cruising is, you can take it or leave it, really. It's like being in a village that you can't leave.
I know my
Midwich cuckoos.
My in-laws were occasional users of the cruise holiday, but they haven't been back yet. I think to put some numbers on it, they have said, I think cruise rates were about 2/3 in the first half of this year, rising to 84% in the second half of pre-pandemic levels. But they do sound quite bullish about next year in that part of the business, which, as you say, is maybe surprising given you would assume a proportion of that business, especially given the demographics involved, would be reticent, you know, about going back at all, really. But yeah, we'll see what happens there. I suppose the other thing to talk about is inflation and the impact that's had on the cost of paying claims seems to have been another reason why profit disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, the inflation is a problem for everyone in that business. It's particularly things like cars. They have quite a big car underwriting business. And the problem they faced is that, you know, the cost of secondhand cars has gone through the roof. But if premiums aren't rising as fast as the cost of inflation. But the problem is, I think, is that they're smaller than the likes of, say, Direct Line or Admiral, and they can't offset that as easily as those bigger companies. So that has hit them as well, and that shows no signs of abating. And unless they can get more business that's better, that has a better percentage in it, I don't know how that's going to turn out, really.
Final question. You know, a question we'll be asking of a lot of UK businesses, even more in the next few weeks, perhaps, than we have all year. You look at the valuation, you know, it's looking pretty cheap on certain forward metrics. It has got a lot of debt, but do you think this could be a takeover target, perhaps?
It does have an attractive, it has certain attractions as a takeover target. I think, I mean, the problem, as you say, is possibly the debt. Who would want to take that on as well as the company?
Yeah, but my feeling
sure
that would
sure.
that would definitely end up in the too hard basket. You know, looking at that, why would another company even consider it given the debt overhang itself?
It's the best part of a billion, isn't it, at the moment that they owe. So it's I mean, if you're going to come in with a premium, you're going to discount whatever the price you pay. You're going to discount the debt, aren't you? So it's I would say it's probably almost neutral.
I don't know. I don't know who would come in for them. Perhaps I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. On that note, we will have to leave it. We have run out of time, but thank you as ever to everyone. Thank you to Hermione, to Mitch, to Mark, and to Julian, and to John. And thank you to you for listening. We will speak to you next week on another Companies and Markets show. Goodbye.